From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Henry David Thoreau, writer and poet, the natural scientist, the guy who went to Walden Pond. Thoreau believed nature could be a source of renewal, that it could heal the deepest acts of human destruction. The scholar Laura Dasso Walls published a biography for Thoreau's 200th birthday, and we're talking about it after this.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. It can seem disappointing to learn the tiny cabin Henry David Thoreau built on Walden Pond was only a few minutes' walk away from the family home in Concord, Massachusetts. I mean, if you're trying to live the life of an isolated ascetic, why not find a place really far away from people? But the scholar Laura Dasso Wall says that's not what Thoreau was doing when he moved to Walden. Dasso Walls completed a biography of Thoreau just in time for his 200th birthday. And in it, she explains how Walden, the book and the cabin, offered Thoreau a place to follow his calling as a spiritual seeker, but it also gave him a public stage to dramatize what she describes as his one-person revolution in consciousness. He wasn't a hermit, she says. He could be prickly and intense and a bit of a nag, but he was also engaged with people. He wanted to encourage them to try what he was trying, to live a deliberate life. Today in the program, Laura Dasso Walls is joining us to talk about her book called Henry David Thoreau, A Life. She's a professor of English at the University of Notre Dame. And I should just say something quick about the way we're pronouncing Thoreau's name. You may say it Thoreau. That's how I usually say it. A lot of people say it that way. But apparently the folks in Concord who still know the Thoreau family pronounce it Thoreau. So that's what we did in the interview. Laura Dasso Wall says everyone who comes to Thoreau has a story. So we began with hers.
I was a teenager and unhappy with my life options. As a woman, I wanted to live an independent life. I didn't know what shape it might take. I wanted to be an artist. I imagined perhaps being an intellectual. And it was tough in the culture of those days. This was in the late 60s. I had earlier found a lovely little book by a writer I didn't know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I had no understanding of what he was saying, but I loved the voice. It was very exciting. And it made me, after a while, think, well, maybe there's more of this. And I was literally in a little bookstore in my hometown, just cruising the shelves looking for something like that. And, of course, shelved next to it was a little book by Thoreau, a little green paperback, Walden and Civil Disobedience, and I pulled it off the shelf and started to read it. And just, that was it. I heard the voice, I read the words, I just was electrified. And I carried it around, reading it and rereading it from then on, and I felt as though this voice was speaking to me out of this deep past and telling me what I needed somebody to be telling me, how to ground myself in a deeper reality, how to orient myself to some higher ambition. This voice was telling me that I could be and do whatever it was that I felt was closest to my own sensibility, my own sort of truest heart. So that voice has been in the back of my head ever since.
You say that the Thoreau you were looking for was not in any book that you could encounter. So I guess in some ways you just wrote your own? Is that fair to say?
You heard the dates going back to the late 60s. Fast forward through many decades of, I've taught many writers. I've done a lot of other things in my life. But the sense I've always had of a kind of conversation with this voice I first discovered when I was a teenager, and that conversation grows and matures with the years. I wrote my first book on Thoreau and science. Over the years, I also have been attending meetings of the Thoreau Society and conversations with many people from around the world about who he was, his thoughts, his philosophy, his writing, what he means to us today, and more and more sense that not only do we know more than we did, that is, even in the last 20 years, we've learned a lot about his life and his time and his town of Concord, but also that our perspective had changed. I mean, there have been intellectual studies. They're quite wonderful. There have been lots of other works that take on various aspects. But in terms of turning to people today and saying this was not some strange loner misanthrope out in the woods telling people to stay away, he was active and engaged and deeply part of the town and lived a happy life in a surprisingly large family. That, to me, changes everything because that makes him much more accessible to us. So that was the impulse behind writing the book the way I did. I wanted to bring that whole time and era alive in a way that would feel very present to us now.
Let me ask you about that misunderstanding of Thoreau. You probably are aware of this. The writer Catherine Schultz wrote this scathing assessment of Thoreau. This was several years ago in the New Yorker magazine. I'm sure you know it. And it's pretty brutal. She said he was self-obsessed and narcissistic and that he was adamant that he required nothing. I'm sort of quoting her here. He required nothing beyond himself to understand and thrive in the world. Now, does that sort of align with your thinking of the misunderstanding of Thoreau?
Yeah, I think that's a very succinct statement of the misunderstandings in a kind of multidimensional way. And I find it, of course, very distressing. So I'm trying to understand both where that attitude comes from and how it functions to close off our understanding of Thoreau and what he could be bringing to us if you are not pursuing that line of thought. What's interesting to me is, first of all, in his own time, people were already voicing that kind of thinking, but not anybody who actually ever met Thoreau. Today we'd call it a meme. It's a kind of powerful cultural meme that's just out there and will not die. But even at the time, based on publicity reports that some of his promoters put out in the newspapers, people concocted this kind of negative fantasy. And his own friends were horrified and spent, even after his death, they were spending a good part of their lives trying to say, that has nothing to do with the person that we knew, and we knew him very, very, very well. So that tradition of saying the negative and then people who have deeply invested in understanding him and trying to come to grips with the depth and range of his philosophy are pushing back and saying, but no, that's not the person we know, and there's a whole lot more there than that point of view allows anyone to imagine. So I found myself in the same position. I didn't respond to that essay because I see it has a long, long foreground, and I simply kept on writing the book that I was writing based on everything I know that's evidence that's in the record abundantly, biographically, historically, through correspondence, through journals, through reminiscences and accounts, Thoreau's own writings, Thoreau's own self-confession, and I just tell that story. I'm not interested, in other words, in refuting this meme because it will not die.
I want to ask you about something you point out really early in the book, that as you were working on it, you started to realize that Thoreau's lifespan had, as you put it, witnessed the arrival of the Anthropocene, this era where humans were changing the planet. And I want to ask you about that because he comes into the world, Thoreau, at this really foreboding time. It's the spring of 1860. He's born in 1817, but there's this strange, horrible, cold weather. Crops are destroyed in New England. This strange weather is taking place all over the world. Would you talk a little bit about this, sort of how the changing part of the planet and how you're thinking about that?
So Thoreau was born in July 12th, 1817. His mother then would have been pregnant during the notorious Year Without a Summer, which is the year, again, it was worldwide. We now know that a huge volcano in Indonesia had erupted and changed the atmospheric chemistry that lowered the global temperature by, I think it was about 1 degree Fahrenheit, which doesn't sound like much, but it was enough to kill crops and create freezing conditions in midsummer right across New England. So farms were failing all across New England. Thoreau was born on a farm. His parents were trying to make a living on a farm, and it wasn't happening. It wasn't working. They couldn't stay on the land. So his birth was shadowed by this this distress, this poverty, this strange, eerie climate that everybody remarked on. What's happening to the world? His parents decided, well, after they had to leave the farm, they cast around for something to do and ended up, you know, pursuing non-farm ways of making a living. But then as we find the older Thoreau, mature, looking from his window out on farmland or taking walks into the farmland, realizing that the deeper ongoing story was the rise of industrial technology represented by the railroad, which carried literally that technology into the heart of Concord and right across Walden Pond. So he's watching that grow, the railroad network grow throughout his life, and watching the transformation that it brings to the countryside, including the collapse of Concord's agricultural economy and the depopulation of the countryside. The towns in the shops on Main Street are closing down because nobody's coming to Concord anymore. They're all taking the railroad into Boston, and so on and so on. So he's responding to this, and Walden becomes the perfect place to observe and think about these changes.
Let's back up just a little and talk about how the family, the Thoreau family, gets involved in the pencil business. His uncle Charles strikes it rich, finds a graphite deposit basically on his land, and this is how the Thoreau family gets into the pencil business. And maybe you should say something. I thought this was so fascinating. Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau, was a terrific pencil maker. He and his father made some of the best pencils in the world. And this is also interesting. You say that his own writing, his working method, co-evolved with these family pencils.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mentioned they were off the farm casting about for a way to make a living. And right in that time period, Uncle Charles is wandering around in the mountains in New Hampshire and comes across a graphite deposit. And this was a very high-quality graphite. It was one of the best mines in known at that time. So he had it tested, and, of course, how can you take advantage of it? Concord already had a little pencil industry. So John Thoreau, the father, put his head together with Uncle Charles, and the two of them started a company, and pretty soon Charles dropped out, and John Thoreau went on his own, making pencils that were not very good, but any pencil is better than none if the alternative is having a little ink pot and a little quill, dipping into your quill into ink. So everybody needs a portable writing instrument, something you just put in your pocket and not worry about, that you can write on anything, write upside down. So the pencil is writing technology that is very, very much in demand. They were very poor quality, and Henry, the younger son, turned out to be the kind of person who likes to use his hands and solve problems and tinker with machinery. And so he's working with his father on, well, how come these pencils are so bad? They're gritty, they're coarse, they break, they don't write very well. And they're looking at the British pencils, which were, you know, superb, high quality. And the French pencils coming in, and they're graded hard to soft, but oh my gosh, they're so expensive. And of course, you want made in America, yeah. Right? So Henry goes to work and solves the problem. He figures out that what you have to do is get a certain kind of clay and bake it with graphite as a kind of ceramic, and you can shape it, and you can grade it hard to soft. And so this is his great breakthrough. He literally invents the number two yellow pencil. It wasn't yellow. It was cedar coated. The yellow was a different company put that yellow paint on it. But yes, and so now he's got a writing instrument. He can put it in his pocket, take a few sheets of paper wherever he goes in any weather, no matter how cold or hot, and he can take notes right as he's in the midst of things. So he's out taking these tiny little scratch notes on everything he sees, just literally minute by minute. And he gets back to his desk, and those little scratch notes, he expands into these marvelous journal entries, and these are the foundation of his writing. All of his writing is tested out and explored first in his journal.
You mentioned earlier, referencing how Thoreau fits in the context of the community of Concord and his family. His father avoided controversies, you say, but his mother, Cynthia... Mm-hmm. You describe her as this vocal defender of liberal causes and kind of went out of her way to fight for a cause. Emerson said she had a malicious wit. I'm wondering, what was the influence? I would have loved to have met Cynthia. I wonder what her influence was on her son.
I wish we knew more about her. And, of course, Thoreau's sisters, too. There seems to have been, among the three women closest to him, three different, very strongly marked personalities. Yes, mother, Cynthia, was famously smart, a good talker. I don't know about the malicious part. Others defended her from those words, people who knew her, by saying she would fight the good cause, right? She would stand up without hesitation in the sharpest of words if she thought something unjust had been said. So this portrait of her as a kind of malicious gossip doesn't stand up to much scrutiny if you look at the historical record. But what does come out is a very forthright personality who gets involved in town affairs, walks right into the middle of things, and is really thoughtful about, she wants to do right. So she's involved in called it the Concord Charitable Society, women who would get together and try to figure out, so who in town needs something that we could do for them? Maybe they need a suit of clothes or a new coat, and we sew up a new coat for them, or, get some money, buy them some tea or coffee or sugar or something. And so, she's there in this circle, and I write about how this is literally stitching together the fabric of the town. So you these women who are watching out for everybody and meeting to say, okay, who needs something that we can get to them? So she's part of that. And then she gets deeply involved in abolitionism as an extension of this group. So who needs something in town? Well, the cause of slavery and the fugitive and freed slaves who are in the area. Personal experience, personal knowledge of living human beings and discovering the politics of slavery and saying, this is an outrage. So this is women who are leading this movement and the women in Thoreau's family who are deeply involved with it. So Cynthia's there. She brings Helen, who is the older, serious, quiet one, and she becomes a co-organizer of the Concord Female Anti-Slavery Society. And then... Henry's sister Sophia is the youngest of the family, and she gets involved too. So people say that Sophia and Henry Thoreau were very much alike. So in Sophia, if you can imagine a female Henry Thoreau who, in a sense, we've lost because we don't have the records, we don't have her writings or her letters, we don't know her at all because the family destroyed the papers. But it's haunting to think of the way the parlor would have sounded. They took in boarders to make ends meet. Cynthia made sure that the people she took in as boarders had something interesting to say. So I'd love to imagine the family conversations around the parlor when they were talking about politics and talking about abolitionism and talking about women's rights and what to do. And Henry would bring in some interesting leaves that he'd found outside, and they'd be passing around leaves and talking about plants and trees. I mean, it was a very exciting, vibrant kind of intellectual community, and the Thoreau household was right at the center of it.
You say nature began as a family communal event for Thoreau. And this is something you explained, mm-hmm. that people believe that Thoreau turned to, quote-unquote, nature, but you say what he was actually turning to was the commons. And there's an important difference here. Would you explain that?
Let's go back to Walden Pond. So, again, our misimpression is that it was wilderness in some far distant place, but of course, if you come to Concord, it's just a very short walk from the center of town. And so people are walking there for all kinds of reasons, some of them practical, like it's a great place to cut a little wood if you need wood for your fire. And it functions as a commons in that people had various traditional legal rights to cut certain kind of wood from certain areas of Walden Pond. So it wasn't owned in the sense that somebody would lay claim to it and put up a fence and sign saying, this is mine, keep out. It was kind of formally and informally regulated as a place where you could go and you could pick huckleberries, you could fish, you could swim in the pond, you could use it recreationally as well as practically. And if you think of that as a town commons, then you have a different perspective on it, because it's very much central to the town life, to normal daily life, and to kind of functions as a kind of backyard for the town. That's a very different perspective on Walden than the kind of wilderness. So if you imagine Thoreau out there watching, for example, he was a surveyor. That's how he made his living. He's out there, and the person who brings the surveying equipment and takes large plots of land, lotting them off for private sale, and he realizes this is happening because he's involved in it and has a very conflicted sense of, I'm going out into these green spaces, these uncut lands, and as a result of what I do, the owners are moving in and cutting the trees and developing this land and often abusing it, treating it without any knowledge of how to sustain the land in a healthy way. So I think it's partly his own involvement with the process that raises his awareness of the commons as the forests that surround the town as well, not just Walden in particular, but more generally the forest, the river, the hilltops, all the places that people were accustomed to going and using and, again, sharing in common. He's not the only one. The whole town, there's a very lively discussion going on as this is happening. The local people are very aware of what they're losing, and they're getting kind of up in arms about, how can we protect our lands, keep them from being clear-cut, and keep the river lots from all being sold so that you can't get access to the river. And Thoreau is in conversation with them and able to create a kind of deeper philosophical foundation for this concept and then put it in language that just sings, that just carries far, far beyond Concord to the world, talking about how every town should have a park of 500 or 1,000 acres for public use forever, to hold in common, a common possession forever, he says, where nobody can do anything in it for their private gain. It's all for the public use, public enjoyment, public recreation, public education. So they do it. Thoreau puts the language out there but the proposal, but it happens. Thoreau doesn't live to see it, but the idea takes wings, and we see it everywhere now in America, but particularly in Concord, which is a beautiful place full of walks and trails and green spaces that they were able to protect.
He has this experience, Thoreau, when he's quite young. It's an experience, in fact, he couldn't get out of his head, you say. He'd been out, I think, with his brother looking for these Indian relics along a riverbank, and he kind of breaks out into this this reverie. And it's an amazing story. It almost seems too good to be true as a story.
He thought so, too.
Yeah, he did. Would you tell it? It's quite great.
Well, roughly, yeah. So he and his brother are rambling around together, and they're young, they're teenagers, and they go to the shore of Concord River, looking across at Neshottoc Hill, which was where the Musketaquid Indians had their town before the English came. And so he's looking across at this location and imagining what it would have been like, and throwing his arms wide and saying, and, you know, here would have been their lodge, and there would have been the hunter returning from the hunt, and here is his arrowhead. And he throws his hand out and drops it onto the ground and grabs something off the ground just as a gesture, and he looks at what is in his hand, and it's a perfect arrowhead. And he is shocked. The coincidence of it just jars him. It can't be true, but he's staring at this arrowhead. And his brother is witness, so they're in this together. And he kind of sits on it for a few weeks, and it's right after Emerson asks him if he's keeping a journal, and he says, "So I make my first entry today." And a few days in, he decides, "Well, let me try to write this up as a story." And it's very interesting to me because up until then, it's just a funny thing that happens. You might tell it to your friends and say, "Yeah, this weird thing happened. I mean, I was just fooling around, but there really was an arrowhead in my hand." But as he writes it, I say that he starts to imagine himself as a writer, because he starts to imagine himself telling the story. Well, it did happen, but there's a larger truth. What can the writer and the artist do with this almost spooky moment? And he starts to feel like there was some kind of communication between himself and the indigenous people, the Indians of the deep past. And it becomes almost a responsibility for him. Like he's been given this arrowhead and this symbolic moment as a sign that he's responsible for doing something more with it. So that becomes the beginning of a long, lifelong engagement with what he calls the Indian. And at first it's very romantic, kind of stereotypical, but the more he actually engages with living native peoples in Concord area, he seeks them out wherever he goes in his travels. And then he goes specifically to Maine three different times. And the second and third time, it is specifically to come to understand the life ways of the Penobscot people, and to meet them firsthand, to travel with them, to talk with them. He writes down as much of their language as he can to try to understand, you know, what are your words for things? How does this world embody itself to you in your language? The more he unpacks that, the larger his interest grows, until when he's asked at one point, "What is your scientific interest?" He says, "The history of the Algonquin peoples." He actually says, "I'm an anthropologist." He doesn't have the word, but that's fascinating, that when he's asked about his scientific study, he essentially says, "I'm an ethnologist, I'm an anthropologist." He doesn't have the training. We don't have that kind of situation available in his lifetime. But he wants to know. He wants to understand. He wants to go find living people. And he starts arguing with all his friends and saying, no, we've got it all wrong. They're not disappearing. They're not vanishing. And they're right here, and we need to understand them, and we need to make sure that they are always part of us, that they are always here, because we need them. They bring to us things that we cannot be, so they think he's nuts.
Right.
Emerson has a great line, you know, he smiles fondly and says, "Oh, Henry talks birch bark to all comers."
Yeah.
You know, don't get him started. Well, he wouldn't stop. Unfortunately, he died before any of this really, really crystallized. We know he was working on some big stuff. We can guess what it might have been, but It's only a guess because he didn't live to finish it.
Thoreau's generation, you mentioned, was the last to know the American Revolution as a, as you put it, a living memory. And there's the story you tell of how Thoreau had learned of one of the last survivors of the revolution, a woman named Anna Jones. Mm-hmm. She was on her deathbed. Yeah, and he runs to interview her. It's interesting. You say that American democracy at the time, and I guess particularly for Thoreau, felt raw and experimental and uncertain. And mm-hmm. and Thoreau, you said, sort of saw the experiment as being incomplete. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah. Well, yes, he did interview Anna Jones, and what was eventually published as an obituary was much shorter and much more conventional than the writing that he actually did. So somebody took it and edited it down, sort of took all the idiosyncratic stuff out. But what he was interested in, we'd call it an oral history. So he's asking about the times and her stories and just writing as whatever she tells him, and she died shortly afterwards. So that's one of our last records of a Revolutionary War survivor. Thoreau was born into a generation that saw themselves as the inheritors of the American Revolution. So literally their fathers and mothers, the grandfathers, grandmothers, are giving them living memories of the great days when they fought the revolution for American independence. And, of course, these kids are looking around and saying, well, yeah, what have we got? How do we participate in this? And there's a widespread sense, so this is not unique to Thoreau, that there's more work to be done. So I mentioned Thoreau and the Native Americans, and, of course, we've talked several times about slavery and abolitionism. And these are two areas. The third was the Mexican War, which Thoreau was in a time and place where everybody thought that war was tragically wrong, a war of conquest that the United States should never have entered in. So it was a very anti-war environment. Thoreau was looking at all of these and saying, this is democracy going wrong. We are acting as if we're an imperial power and we can just we can enslave peoples, we can remove native peoples from their land, we can invade Mexico and claim it for ourselves. This is not democracy, this is something else, and we need to reclaim democracy as conditions under which everyone can flourish, not just a certain sector of population, but all people have the right to be part of this functioning citizenry that constitutes a democracy. And of course, as they're talking about this, as he's writing about this, as they're connecting with widening abolitionist movement, they're watching the nation polarize around the question of slavery. The South is defending slavery, and more voices in the North are saying slavery is an abomination that must end. And so the polarization increases, and Thoreau finds himself becoming ever more vocal in defense of what he sees as the absolutely core concept of democracy, which is you cannot take away anyone else's rights in order to enhance your own self-interest. That is an abomination and an ethical outrage. So civil disobedience states that really forcefully. Yeah.
Henry David Thoreau's relationship with his brother John, I was really moved by. They're wandering around playing Indian as they used to play, and it created this deep bond with them. And then you write about, of course, how in 1842, John slices off the skin of his ring finger, comes down with lockjaw, dies in Henry's arms. What effect did this have? Because you say this really changed in some ways, or certainly motivated Thoreau's thinking and his the way he was looking at the world, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, you have to understand John was the older brother, and everybody says that he's the one. He walked into the room, all heads turned towards John. He just lit up the room. He was charismatic and fun and funny and electric, told great stories. He was a teacher. His students loved him. He would romp with the kids, and he was athletic. And they also adored his quiet, introspective little brother, Henry. So when you see the two of them you know, exploring the woods together, canoeing and hiking and finding the nearest hilltop. You have to imagine that John is the one who's the older, the guide, the one who's saying, let's go here. And Henry is the little brother who's loving the attention and loving the kinship that they're developing together. And then when John dies in Henry's arms, this trauma, they were very close. Henry refers to being half of one, mm-hmm. right? This sense that John's death is part of himself dying, and he doesn't know who he is after John has gone. And he didn't know that the universe could do that kind of outrage and disbelief that I think many of us have experienced, that you cannot trust the universe wholly after something you love, someone you love that deeply is gone. So it takes a long time for him to come out of the deep, deep depression that he falls into. His sisters try to take him out. You know, Henry, you love to walk. Let's walk out into the woods. And it's just gone dead. Everything is dead to him. And it's only until he starts to think about John as alive still in the woods and in the rivers and in all the places that they shared together all those years that he starts to come alive again himself. So there's a real sense in which he identifies John as the one who went before, and he walks out into the woods to follow John, and to he even writes a poem about this, that John, his voice is still there in all the voices of the woods, and what Henry has to do is simply pause, still his mind and still his heart, and be quiet and listen. Be receptive and listen. And he will hear those voices that speak to him of the past, of their happy years together. And it sounds a little sentimental, but it really does become this generative way for Henry to deal with the loss. And in the middle of this kind of spiritual reawakening as part of the healing process, Emerson does something brilliant. He hands Henry a stack of natural history books and says, I don't know what to do with these. Would you just write up a review of these for the Dial, the magazine that Emerson was editing? And going through these natural history books, now he's got a writing assignment. Henry starts to write about those moments and starts to realize, I have a subject to write about here. This is mine. This is what matters to me. And just the exhilaration of putting words on paper that start to express, they just come tumbling out of him. It's just an amazing moment. He's Henry. He's discovered himself. And this is about 2-3 months after John's death. It's just this deep slump and then this sudden blossoming as he finds the voice. And he never loses it. That's the voice, and it just grows and develops from then on.
Laura Dasso-Walls, her book is Henry David Thoreau, A Life. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
On the next More to Say, we're picking up on a conversation we started last week about affordable housing in Utah. This is part of KUER's Hive Mind project, where you ask our reporters questions and they try to find the answers. This time, it's all about tiny homes. Maybe you've seen them on Instagram, those beautifully apportioned, incredibly small houses. People go nuts for this stuff. Things get complicated, though, for one couple when a nosy neighbor spots their tiny home in a friend's backyard. Download the next More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Laura Dasso-Walls. We're talking about her biography, Henry David Thoreau, A Life. Let's talk about when Thoreau found Charles Darwin. This is, of course, later in his life, although he didn't live very long.
Oh, yeah.
Turns out he was one of the I didn't realize this. He was one of the first Americans to read Darwin's Origin of the Species from cover to cover in this country.
Yeah. I say the one of the first. I used to say the first, and then realized that the copy, it was an author's copy that Charles Darwin sent to Asa Gray, who the Cambridge a Harvard botanist who had worked with Darwin on developing the theory of evolution and had contributed a lot of knowledge to Darwin from the United States about flora. So, of course, the first copy was Asa Gray's, but the copy that came to Thoreau's hands came by way of a cousin of Asa Gray's, who was a mutual friend who was visiting his aunt and uncle, took this book with him on New Year's Day, 1860, to Concord, to show all his friends in Concord. And they're all gathered together in a parlor reading this book, Origin of Species, aloud to each other. And, you know, so Thoreau, what I've heard is that Thoreau was one of the first to bring it home, that book home. I'm not sure that it was that copy, but it was one of the very, very earliest copies available. And we know he read it cover to cover because he took notes. And so we have his notes, and they're from all over the book. So before people have even heard of this book, he's already got it open on his desk, and he's copying out passages and getting very, very excited about how this just puts the picture of the universe together. And what I like about it is that he's copying out really interesting passages that show that he's processing Darwin's most radical suggestions. So it wasn't so much evolution, because a lot of theories of evolution had been proposed, and Thoreau was already very much on board with evolution. Darwin had proposed a mechanism for evolution, and Thoreau was there jotting down notes where you can see he's testing out the mechanism, like, well, what would this mean exactly? How would you see it in your own common, like, how could you see this around Concord? Where would I go and look to see evidence that would either prove Darwin right or prove him wrong? And that interests me because that means he's really, really radically ahead of pretty much anybody right at that moment, right up there on the cutting edge of scientific thinking.
It's interesting because in the last year and a half of his life, he seemed to be heading into this really vibrant phase of exploration. He goes back and rereads Darwin, and you say those ideas kind of started to come to life for him. So I hear he's back out into the woods, and this new work you say he was doing was helping him, as he put it, mend his destiny.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, there'd been some difficult years. He'd been very ill, and then his father fell ill and eventually died. That meant that he now was responsible for the family and for the pencil business, which was now a graphite business. So now he's a man of business, and he's not getting out into the woods so much, and there's just a lot of stress. And somewhere right around this moment, just before he finds Darwin, he rebalances, and I think that probably Sophia took over the family business, and that, you know, he worked out a way of getting back out into the woods the way he wanted to. And there is a surge of energy, and one reason Darwin becomes so important to him is that Thoreau has been pursuing this question of seeds and seed dispersal for a number of years to solve a problem in terms of forest succession. The problem is, you know, every farmer knew that if you cut down an oak forest, what would immediately spring up was pines. And if you'd cut down a pine forest, what would immediately spring up is oak trees, little oak trees. I mean, this is just baffling. It makes no sense, right? So Thoreau's been working on that for years. He's reading Origin of Species, this hot new book from England, and Darwin mentions this exact same problem and says, you know, we don't understand how this happens. And he's got the answer. He's had the answer for years. He's like, I know that one. Even Darwin doesn't understand this one. I do. And so then he reads Darwin saying, if you could understand the distribution of seeds, you would understand everything you needed to know about the theory of evolution, but we don't understand the distribution of seeds. And Thoreau again is saying, that's what I do. My whole thing is distribution of seeds. I've been thinking about it. I've been tracking seeds. I've been writing about it for years. And he just goes incandescent. His journal lights up. It's vivid. He's out there every day. The journal pages get, you know, the entries are huge and they're full of life. He's exploring everywhere. He's got the big new idea. He's so excited. It's all coming together. He develops a kind of an ecological research station up on the top of Mount Monadnock. And he's out there in the midst of this, and he catches a cold from a friend. And the cold exacerbates it. It triggers the latent tuberculosis he's been fighting. And it's the end. It's it just very, very soon he's can't go out at all, and not long after that he can no longer write. All of this is in his journal, and it's in some of the very last writings, but none of this was really known until pretty recently.
I mean, he had been advised to get out of New England, that his lungs couldn't take another winter there, and so he thinks, well, I'll go west, and then he settles on Minnesota, which is a strange place to think of for mild weather, but there it is, and he doesn't last very long there. He comes back, and you say that when he returned, he said he knew he only had a few months to live, and there's a photograph, an ambrotype, I guess that's how it's pronounced.
Right.
Taken of Thoreau during these last months. Two, in fact, were taken. One was stolen. It's disappeared, which is interesting. But I wanted you to just say something about that image, that last image that we have of him. In the book, you say that his gaze holds ours, and it's sad as a requiem.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Given that he lived a joyous life, but his eyes are so deeply sad in that image, and you could say he does know that he's dying. For a man so full of life and so involved in life as the very, I guess, to be the person who wants to understand seeds and, you know, he wants to understand streams and river flow and, you know, things that move and things that live. He wants to understand flight and watches hawks. And so here's this wild spirit who wants to understand and be part of life and the flow, and he finds himself being shut down. And in his writing and his address to friends, he's serene about this in a way that is really kind of uncanny. But in that photograph, his eyes are so sad, and it makes me feel the sense that his serenity is it's hard for him to earn that serenity. He really feels this is a part of the cosmos that still fundamentally makes no sense, right? He should have lived. He had so much more to do and so much more to give, and he knew that, and yet what's happening is he cannot control. So the universe is wilder than we are. And, you know, confronting the wildness of your own mortality in a universe that can take you out like this is the kind of ultimate problem, and he's facing it. I see that in his eyes. I also see sadness at the politics of the time and the era, the sense that all the words that he's put out there in the world, all the change that he's tried to create, and he feels that things are, he's been out to West, he's seen the Civil War breaking out all across the nation on his return. This deep sense that things are going off the rails, he can't stop it. He can't be a part of it. And the loss of his friends, you know, the sense that he's leaving them behind, all of that I see in his eyes.
Early in the book, you asked this question, can Thoreau's faith in nature live on after nature? You say you think it can.
I think it can. I think it can because he faced this basic problem of nature being, we are not in control. We like to think we are, but we are fundamentally not, either as individuals, but not as a species either. And this is the lesson of the Anthropocene. It's not about how it's named for us because we're in charge now. It's named for us because we have now tipped the system beyond our control. The system is in control. That is, the planet itself is in control. We don't even understand completely. We have a pretty good understanding of the basic physics of it, but not a fundamental understanding of what exactly this is going to do to us and how this is going to play out. So this is the great uncertainty. And we've triggered planetary chemistry that is taking its path, irrespective of our needs and our desires and our plans. And that sense that nature is bigger than we are, is something that Thoreau encountered many times in his life, but most memorably on a mountaintop in Maine, Mount Katahdin. And he accepts that. There's a kind of surrender to the wild in that moment that he never loses, that I see helping us today as we realize that we're writing a future that we cannot imagine and we cannot control. Thoreau, I do think, understood that, and insofar as he found a way to accept that, I think that his faith in nature can survive. But I'm saying that with some hesitation because I don't know. It's easy to look in the past and start drawing conclusions about, you know, how this played out in the 19th century. But now we're the ones on the cusp, and I'm not certain that it will survive. I think it can, but again, his is the voice that can help us work through this terrible, tragic difficulty that we're in. And many of us find him a great strength in facing the uncertainties of our own time.
It's Laura Dasso Walls. Her new biography is Henry David Thoreau, A Life. She joined us from Thoreau's hometown of Concord, Massachusetts. That's where she was attending a conference about his life and work on the 200th anniversary of his birth. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Adrian Moranville. Our thanks to David Goodman. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.